You're tuned to Focus on Campus, a weekly show which highlights faculty, staff, and students here at the University of Texas at El Paso. Good morning, I'm Luis Sanz, your host for Focus on Campus, and joining us today is Charlie Min. Charlie is a director, producer, basically a Renaissance man, and he's has been speaking to various classes here at UTEP in our community department, also communication department. Also, let me start that over again. I'll just do that again. With us today is Charlie Min. Charlie is the producer, director of various films focusing on the El Paso Juarez area, and he's been speaking to classrooms and classes here at El Paso Community College, at UTEP. Where else in El Paso have you been talking, Charlie?
High schools.
High schools, okay. So Charlie's been all around El Paso, and he's well-known, and his latest film was called Es el Chapo, and he's recently back to talk about the massacre that happened in Las Cruces on February 10th, 1990. Charlie, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, as I mentioned, you've been visiting with classes here at UTEP, at El Paso Community College, various high schools. And what specifically do you talk to them about? I know when you came here, what was it, 5 years ago or so?
Yeah, and you were the guy who really was instrumental in getting me introduced to UTEP. So a colossal thank you to you.
Well, thank you. You talk to them about filmmaking, but you also talk to them because you have a lot of passion, Charlie, and people can see that when you speak to the classes.
For this area in particular, there's a lot of important stories here that deserve coverage, need more coverage. The Juarez tragedy, obviously, is something that hurt a lot of El Pasoans because we have friends and family members over there. 12,000 people were murdered in Juarez in the last 6 years. Thankfully, the situation has gotten better. In this case, the Las Cruces Bowling Alley Massacre, that's how you and I actually first met. And I was struck when you told me that you were on scene that day. So I know this is a very personal crime for you.
It is. And in fact, it was one of the reasons I decided to leave television news, because it was it was hard to take to watch that.
Yeah, this affected so many people, devastated so many people. And the fact that it's still unsolved 25 years later makes the whole thing worse. So that's why I'm releasing a part two of A Nightmare in Las Cruces. Part one will come before part two. There's 30 to 40 minutes of new scenes. So I think bringing it back out there during a landmark anniversary like 25 years is appropriate.
Now, when you talk about part two, what in addition to what you just mentioned, new scenes, do you have? Do you have interviews with other people who have taken over the investigation?
Yeah, we have two major scenes, Louis. The first one is a conference room scene we shot right here at UTEP, actually, in a conference room. Was two old detectives, and who's in part one, and also one of the victims, Anthony Terran. He lost his brother and his two nieces in the brutal attack. And then the other major scene is with the current detective, Amador Martinez. He was not in the first part because he wasn't involved in the case, but now he is. He took over the case about a year ago, so a lot of pressure on Amador Martinez. So we have a recent sit-down interview with him. That interview was actually just done 2 weeks ago, so this is very recent.
We talk about, you know, we watch television shows, we read stories, and we see the detectives working on cold cases, and this would be considered a cold case. But unlike television or shows, movies, where you see the detectives, you know, going back to something and perhaps they end up finding something, in this case, it's not really just a cold case. It's an very active cold case because it's affected the whole community, as you mentioned.
Yeah, this devastated a city. This devastated the area. A lot of El Pasoans took this hard. I mean, it's hard for me to go 2 days in a row without someone bringing this up to me, some stranger on the street. The Bowling Alley Massacre hit a lot of people, and the fact that it's unsolved makes it worse. So, I mean, I think if people didn't see the first part, then watching the second part, they'll be completely covered because they'll see parts one and two.
It's interesting because it was 5 years ago that we talked about this, but people may not remember or realize why you stumbled onto this, and it was back when you were still, a young man, a teenager, or in high school, college.
Yeah, I was in college, and I saw it on Unsolved Mysteries, a national crime show. So that's the power of it being national, that you could hit anybody with the story. So I saw it. I wasn't a filmmaker at the time. Had I been a filmmaker at the time, I probably would have made this film right when it happened. But circumstances led me to do it years later, at the 20-year anniversary. And here we are sitting at the 25-year anniversary, basically in the same spot. The only difference is that we have a new detective. We're waiting for some lab tests to come back. Hopefully with new DNA technology, this will be solved. And people can go online to research it more at bowlingmassacre.com. Colder cases have been solved than this one. I've seen cases 25, 30, 35 years that have been solved. So who knows what will end up happening with this one.
Now, when people see the first part, and I know that you showed clips in some of the classes that you lectured to here at UTEP and at El Paso Community College, in that they see the detectives and also the sketches of who they think are the suspects. And based on those sketches, people may wonder, well, are the suspects even still alive?
That's right. I mean, are they looking for people who have passed on? Maybe one's passed on, one's alive. Are the sketches accurate? I mean, these were given by witnesses that were shot. And when you're shot, your judgment could easily be affected. So, and the killers then started a fire on the desk. They shot all seven people inside the bowling alley, inside the office, about a half an hour before it was to open, set the office on fire, then simply walked out the front doors. So, and then one of the first responding officers put the fire out with water, with a hose, either that or a fire extinguisher, one of those. And water is bad for a crime scene, any liquid, because that could dilute evidence. And that one policeman who did that today, to this day, he's haunted because he felt he should have put the fire out with a blanket, because analysts want a dry crime scene. So you have a fire, you have water, you have blood, you have no DNA technology back then. You're barely out of the 80s here. You have sketches that may not be accurate. The killers could be dead. This is very difficult for any police department to solve.
Now, in part two, do the detectives give us hope as far as because, as you mentioned, new technology as far as finding stuff and seeing things they didn't see before?
I mean, you know, I asked a detective before the interview. I said, what can you tell us? What can you not tell us? And obviously, they're not going to reveal anything that they feel would compromise the investigation. They're not going to tell us anything that only the killers would know. For instance, they're never going to let me know exactly how much money was stolen from the safe. They have the exact number there somewhere. So if someone were to walk in today and say, I committed the massacre in Las Cruces in the bowling alley in 1990, eventually they'll be asked, okay, how much was stolen? And if they get it right to the very number, then they have to hold him. How did he know that? So I know certain things. There's a lot I don't know. There's a lot of us that don't know a lot because the police, they just cannot simply tell us everything.
Now, your films focus a lot on people, and as I said, you have a lot of passion. They focus on the victims. They focus on the crimes. But not all your stories are based on, you know, horrific crimes, anything like that. You've made some films that also highlight special people and, you know, special groups. And the one that stands out is, of course, the basketball player and the manager.
The Coronado Franklin.
Yes.
Sure. The Jonathan Montanez from Franklin gave Mitchell Marcus, the special needs student, the basketball in February of 2013. And what's weird about that is that incident happened on February the 12th and the bowling alley happened on February the 10th. It just so happens. But that's a heartwarming story that got national attention. It got on ESPN. They went on Ellen, Mitchell and his family, and Jonathan and his family. And all my films I look back on and I remember the process and remember how powerful the story is.
Tell me, because you know, you said you got interested in this when you were in college. So when you speak to college classes, what is it that you see in the students and perhaps they bring out in you that makes you keep going around and talking to these students?
Well, my topics are deep. I would consider them all deep humanity. And I think it's only going to mature a young student, as they move forward in their academic careers. I mean, these are stories that are not discussed every day. Not too many people want to volunteer information about the Juarez tragedy. It's affected so many lives, so many people. You talk to them about the bowling alley. You talk to them about other issues with deep humanity. And I think that could only mature a young student, increase their courage level, increase their intelligence, challenge them to think harder about things, and at the end mature them and they become a better person.
Now, what about you as a director, as a producer? You're on the scene and you've gone into some of these areas where your life possibly could be in danger.
Yeah, absolutely. I never think once that this my life is on the line with a lot of these films, Louis. I mean, going into Sinaloa to do a movie about Chapo Guzman. I mean, that's not exactly going into Orlando and doing a movie about Mickey Mouse. I mean, this is a serious issue. in Esther Chapo, the opening scene is a shootout that we're literally right in the middle of. In Juarez, I would go into the war zone at night. Three films in Juarez. And my next film could be about those 43 students that were murdered in Guerrero. You talk about injustice. And I feel bad for the families. I know the parents are very outspoken. The grieving parents are ones that really affect me the most, like the grieving mothers in Juarez. We lost 12,000 people in Juarez in the last 6 years, and those people should never be forgotten, the innocent ones. And that's the hard thing that I have to accept is how many – the question I keep asking myself is out of the 12,000 people who were murdered in Juarez in the last 6 years, what percentage were innocent? I would do anything for that figure. What do you think that is, Louis?
I think a good number of them are innocent.
70%, would you say?
At least.
Okay.
And in your films, you also talk to, as you mentioned, the victims. You've got video and about, you know, talking to investigative journalists in Mexico, some detectives, some people affected. And when they see you out there, how do they respond to you? Because obviously you stand out.
Well, they've been very forthcoming. I mean, I have the ability to get people to talk. I don't know what it is, but maybe they trust me. Maybe they trust where I'm coming from. I don't know. But I think after making 16 movies in 5 years, my instincts kick in. And I know how to make a movie. I could bang out a documentary in 4 months. I usually do three a year about deep topics. And the Mexican people have treated me beautifully. I can't say enough about that. I mean, people think that, oh, this is a deep topic, tough topic. How do you make these films? It's my job. It's my duty. And yes, it's dangerous, but I wouldn't have it any other way.
As a filmmaker, you live in New York City. And when you go back, as I mentioned before, and you've mentioned it, that the El Paso Southwest, Juarez, you have a passion for it. And I know that you make a lot of comments online sometimes about injustices and things going on. When you go back home to New York City and you talk to friends, family, and perhaps other filmmakers, do they question you about, is that really happening or can they believe, really?
I try to separate my personal life from what I do for a living. And when I go back home, I mean, people, I would say 90% of the people in our country are disconnected to the violence in Mexico, the Mexico tragedy. They don't really have a feel for it. So when I go back to New York, it's really not brought up that much. But I do sincerely love El Paso. I always think about El Paso. I always think about what's going on in El Paso. And when I'm in New York, I literally have 1 foot in El Paso. I'm always studying what's going on in that city. What's the latest? So even though I leave, my mind is still in El Paso. And it's the area that started my career. The people have supported me tenfold. It's a great community, and I think I'll permanently be here. I'll always make films. I might make them in New York, Arizona, L.A., but I'll always have some residence here.
How do you go about selecting your topics for the movies?
That's a good question. I mean, there's so many important topics out there, and I have to decide what is doable, what's realistic. And a lot of films do not get made. I know I realize I'm making it look easy right now, but there's a lot of topics that did not get made. Right now I'm trying to raise money to do a movie about El Paso High School. The 100-year anniversary for their high school is next year. UTEP just celebrated it, and now El Paso High is about to celebrate it. Don Haskins, 50-year anniversary of that win by Texas Western over Kentucky. The 50-year anniversary is next year. Louis, there are some incredible stories here, milestone anniversaries that need coverage.
It's interesting that you bring up El Paso High School because that is one of the buildings designed by Henry Trost, and there are a lot of Trost buildings in the El Paso area under perhaps, you know, they're in danger because some people want to tear them down and turn them into parking lots or something else like that, and Trost has a big, big legacy here in El Paso.
Well, it's bad enough that the Asarco stacks went down. I mean, it's bad when things are taken away from our culture.
Charlie, why don't you tell us again when this film is going to be shown?
Yeah, it opens on the very day of the anniversary, February the 10th. That's the Nightmare in Las Cruces Part 2. Part 1 will come before Part 2, so there's 30 to 40 minutes of new scenes. It opens up at Bassett Place Mall in El Paso. It's going to run for at least a week. Partial proceeds go to the victims. It's also going to open up at the mall in Las Cruces. You got to show the movie where it happened, where the city where it happened. And for more information, people can go on bowlingmassacre.com.
Once again, we've been visiting with Charlie Min. Charlie is a director, producer of various films, documentaries, and his latest one is A Nightmare in Las Cruces, Part 2, and that will open on February 10th, which is the 25th anniversary of the massacre, and it'll open up at the Bassett Center Place. Also, other areas, and you can go to www.bowlingmassacre.com. Charlie, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Louis.
Focus on Campus is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, DJ Orozco. You've been tuned to Focus on Campus. I'm Louis Sainz.